Hello and welcome to Making Media Now, the Filmmakers Collaborative Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Azevedo. On our last episode, we chatted with Peter Yost, whose film Nazi Town USA premiered on PBS's American Experience series in January. I worked on American Experience for a few seasons many years ago, and I've always held the series and its filmmakers in the highest regard. Joining me on this episode are Amanda Pollock and Gene Tempest, the team behind another new American Experience documentary. This one premieres on PBS on March 26th and is called The Cancer Detectives. The Cancer Detectives tells the story of how one of the most impactful life-saving tests for women was created and popularized by a Greek immigrant and his wife, a famous Japanese-American illustrator who was detained in a World War II internment camp, and a groundbreaking black female surgeon. This dramatic story of the fight against cervical cancer revolves around three main characters who worked tirelessly and overcame numerous setbacks in order to save the lives of thousands of women. The work of these three lifesavers slashed death rates of this previously unfightable cancer by more than 60%. Here's the film's trailer.
Costly cancer deaths. They deprive the world of too many people we love.
Cancer was deeply feared at this time.
It was essentially a death sentence. By the time they found out that it was cancer, it was too late.
The notion of trying to find a cervical cancer early wasn't on anyone's radar screen, and nobody thought there was a way to do that.
This is the doctor, George N. Papanicolaou, Professor Emeritus of Cornell Medical College.
He realizes that you can find cancer before it technically exists. That really is unprecedented.
To have accurate, powerful illustrations of those cells was completely fundamental to the success of George's work.
Moriyama used colors in a way that made differences in the cells much easier to identify.
Dickens would do workshops like Cancer in Women, Cancer in the Uterus.
She understands some of the trepidation. She's saying, look, I'm a product of this, and I'm telling you that you can trust me.
She thought that if she could just spread Dr. Papanicolaou's technique, it was life-saving.
Less is spent on cancer research than we spend on chewing gum.
What begins to happen is women carving out an identity for themselves really as public health activists.
The Pap test really became a life-saving test.
Co-director Amanda Pollock has been making highly acclaimed documentaries for public television for more than two decades. As a partner at Insignia Films, she began her tenure by producing the series Reporting America at War, and then moved on to create several American Experience films, including The Sun Queen, Citizen Hearst, Las Vegas, Custer's Last Stand, and The Great War, among others. She recently produced Into the Grand Canyon, an environmental adventure story that premiered on National Geographic and is now streaming worldwide on Disney+. Co-director Gene Tempest is an award-winning American filmmaker and historian. Her writing has appeared in the Boston Globe and the New York Times, and her screenwriting has been recognized by the Writers Guild of America. She's taught at SUNY Cortland and Boston University, and from 2016 to 2017, served as the first ever historian in residence for American Experience at GBH Boston, where she helped fund and develop new history programming for public television. Making Media Now is sponsored by Filmmakers Collaborative, a nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting media makers from across the creative spectrum. From providing fiscal sponsorship to presenting an array of informative and educational programs, Filmmakers Collaborative supports creatives at every step in their journey. To learn more, visit filmmakerscollab.org. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please do follow and share. Now on to my conversation with Amanda Pollock and Gene Tempest. Amanda Pollock and Gene Tempest, welcome to Making Media Now.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure to be speaking with each of you. And we're here to chat about your film, The Cancer Detectives, which is going to be broadcasting on PBS as part of the American Experience series, airing on March the 26th.
So your film begins around 1928, covers about a 30-year period of time. Give us a sense at the start of that period, what was the state of cancer research and sort of cancer insight within the medical scientific community and sort of the perception within the public at large around how pervasive cancer might have been?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny because there's both a lot of echoes to today and then, you know, at the same time, a lot of differences. I mean, I think when we look back to the 1920s, people had been aware of cancer as a disease for a very, very long time. You know, and cancer was known going all the way back. And there's been a lot of work about just how far into ancient civilization, you know, they were aware of this disease. But at the same time, you know, even today, we still struggle with how it functions, you know, how it actually works. And in the 20s, cancer research was really in its infancy. And the bigger problem was that, you know, certainly in American society, this was not a disease that was really talked about. This was something that you would sort of suffer in silence. We didn't even have words to describe the affliction necessarily. You know, I think it was known as the dread disease. And you often wouldn't even have the diagnosis mentioned, or the patients might not even be told. I mean, there's a lot of differences, I think, on the cultural side. Mm-hmm. But certainly, you know, people were aware. To have that kind of fear, you know, on the other side means that that there was a knowledge. It just wasn't openly talked about.
And for listeners' benefits, that was Gene Tempest, who is the writer and co-director of the film. And I ask you a very basic question here. What makes a cancer a cancer?
I just wanted to add to Gene's answer to the first question, which is that I think one other notable thing is that at that moment, a diagnosis of cancer was really a death sentence. We have come such a long way, and the Pap smear was part of that, but we've come such a long way in terms of our understanding of cancer and the treatments available for cancer. And back at that time, there was very little of that. So once you had that cancer diagnosis, it was almost certainly kind of meant the end of your life. So it really loomed as this terrifying specter out there.
When we're calling something a cancer, what the medical community means by that is what? What has been observed at the cellular level?
I mean, that's really, it's funny, you know, the question, what makes a cancer is in effect what this film is about. You know, it's called The Cancer Detectives because what this man, George Papanicolaou, set out to do was basically classify cancerous cells for the first time. So this story that's unfolding in the 1920s is about figuring out exactly what you're saying. You know, what makes a cancer on the cellular level? How can we tell how the cells are changing, how they're progressing, and how to identify them? You know, can we actually, and this was an open question at the time, tell what cancer looks like if we're just looking at a collection of cells? So I think, you know, for the general public, Amanda and I make, you know, we make historical documentaries, so it's more about the culture and stuff around all these things. But, you know, this is very much a story about cells and the people who really made the study of cancerous cells and their evolution, their life's work.
And Papanicolaou was able to look at cancer on a cellular level and begin to notice sort of how the cell structures were changing and how he could see in these pap smears that he was beginning to take, you know, he could visually identify under the microscope these abnormal cells that represented cancer. And what was so particularly astounding about it was that he was able to identify it long before the cancer had really become what we now think of as cancer, the dangerous cancer. It was really pre-cancer.
So let's talk a little bit about this immigrant from Greece, George Papanicolaou. Did I say that correctly? I've been practicing. Dr. Pap is much easier.
Yes.
Amanda, tell us a little bit about the research that he was involved in around 1928 that birthed essentially what came to be known as the pap smear.
He had come over from Greece as a young man with his wife and was able to secure himself a position at Cornell in the laboratory there. And he was looking at, he was sort of doing research into reproductive health. And this is an aspect of the story. Basically, he was working in a laboratory that was involved to some extent in eugenics research, which was very commonplace at that time. So looking into reproduction at the moment was very much part of this larger conversation about reproductive health and the way in which that was going to affect society at large. But so he was actually doing research on guinea pigs, and he was trying to understand the ways in which sex determination was reflected at the cellular level in guinea pigs. And so he was, you know, looking at these smears that he was taking from the guinea pigs, and he started noticing that you could actually trace the reproductive cycle of a female guinea pig by looking at their smears, their pap smear or their smears, you know, over time. You're really hitting me with the hardest part of this film. Jean is laughing because she knows how much we both struggled with, you know, how to make this clear in the film is this early research that Dr. Papanicolaou was doing.
I think you succeed in the film.
That's the gist of it.
Yeah, I do think you succeed in the film, most definitely. So you mentioned eugenics. Tell me about what was the relationship between the study of eugenics, perhaps the championing of the theories around eugenics, and the work that Dr. Papp was doing at the time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we have to remember that we're in basically the early genetic revolution. You know, when we look back to this time, we're talking about early ideas about inheritance. You know, Darwin and Mendel and these guys with their peas and their birds are not that far away from, you know, Papanicolaou in New York City. And so, you know, even when he's a graduate student, he's immersed in these ideas. It's the hottest science out there. You know, it's the AI of its day is to look into and how genes work. When it comes to eugenics and basically applying some of these ideas from biology to ideas concerning human reproduction, it's incredibly commonplace. You know, to answer your question, like this is not just in biological, zoological research, but also across medicine in the United States. This was a, you know, really a big branch, and it's something that I think, you know, in making the film, we were surprised actually by how extensive and, you know, it really was and how pervasive across these sciences, these kinds of ideas were. And, you know, and a lot of researchers were wrestling with, you know, if you can only understand inheritance, if you can understand these kinds of traits, can you change them? Can you use them to, quote unquote, improve the stock of humankind? You know, and these were the ideas that they were working on and talking about.
And for the sake of definition, when we speak of eugenics, we're speaking of what?
So, you know, eugenics is the study of the quote unquote improvement of the human species. And it's kind of like, you know, thinking about improving any kind of racing horse, except instead of horses, you know, they're talking about human beings. It's really important to say up front and right away that this is also often a very explicitly and inherently racist science that's really interested in categorizing what's quote unquote fit, what's quote unquote best. And those are usually meaning, you know, white and in this country, Protestant usually types of families. So that's important to say as well.
And at the time, running parallel to these ideas around eugenics, there was also some really interesting, I guess, theories around cancer and certain populations that were susceptible or perhaps not susceptible to cancer. And Amanda, your film goes into that. Could you touch upon that for a bit, if you would?
Yeah, one of the prominent theories at the time was that Black people were less prone to cancer, that they were somehow not as susceptible to cancer. And as a result, they were, you know, there were a lot of campaigns that were sort of burgeoning in the 30s. The movement to sort of fight cancer was growing. And there was something called the Women's Field Army that really went out and was going door to door and trying to raise awareness around cancer. But it very much was excluding the Black community. And so that was something that was really important to us in the film, was to sort of get at this bifurcated way in which cancer is being seen across different communities and being, you know, who's being educated about it and who's not.
And what was undergirding those theories around African-Americans not being susceptible to cancer?
You know,
ignorance.
I think that's an elegant way to put it, Amanda. And you know, and certainly racism as well. You know, the culture surrounding this disease often had as many impacts as, you know, the medicine around it. And I think that, you know, there's this idea that you see starting to come out in the 1920s, that cancer is, you know, is quote unquote, the disease of civilization. That is, we're entering the 20th century, that you start to see cancer, you know, in Northern European countries, you start to see cancer in the United States. This is a perception. This is not the medical reality, but that it is among the civilized people, especially, that this is a problem, and with heavy quotes around civilized, obviously. And so there is this cultural side that then impacts the actual care that people are able to receive and to get. But we were able to work with some really, you know, inspiring scholars who have actually looked at this history and looked at the impacts of, you know, of these way, the impacts on actual populations of this way of looking at this disease, and who, you know, who's left out of the conversation when you assume that Black Americans don't get cancer, when you assume that large portions of the world are not susceptible to cancer. You know, the other thing to say is that in the 20s at this time, and this is also kind of interesting, cancer is really believed to be a disease of women, you know, so men were also largely excluded. And again, this has to do with a bunch of cultural factors. So I think bringing the cultural history and these other forces at play into the film was really important to us throughout, you know, because we're talking about science, but, you know, it's never in a vacuum, as we know all too well, even today.
Sure. And we're talking about a period of time also where we're only 60 years or so removed from slavery. And as your film very vividly points out, the origins of gynecology actually had its roots in the treatment of slaves. And that led to a distrust of the medical establishment in among many African American women, and so that creates a pretty steep hill to climb for anybody who's trying to encourage healthcare advocacy, particularly among that population. Amanda, when you were researching to put this film together, how did evidence of that growth of gynecology come to the fore? What was backing those findings?
Well, I think it was, you know, one thing is it was very important to us. This was a film looking at sort of the evolution of the science and of the pap smear. And part of that story is the science, the cellular story, and the discovery that George Papanicolaou made along with the assistance of his wife, Mary. But another huge part of that story was the way in which this new science was able to make it out to the population at large, and how we were able to win hearts and minds. And so to us, you know, that's really where Helen Dickens came into our story as kind of the avatar for that side of it. And the way, and and the way in which she was really navigating this mistrust that you're talking about and working in this community in which, you know, it's not easy to get people to adapt to this new life-saving medical innovation. Yeah, I mean, I think that it was really important to us to sort of show the ways in which she worked within the community to develop trust and to counter this history, this legacy in which gynecology really had been developed, you know, through the exploitation of Black women's bodies over time. So,
and Helen Dickens becomes an MD at age 26, practicing in Philadelphia. Jean, what can you tell us about Helen Dickens and how integral to this story she is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think just to back up even for 1 second, just for you know, listeners who won't have seen the film yet, but who now I hope will be, could not be more excited to hear about more guinea pigs and more people. So I do encourage them to rush. But just to back up, I think it's important to say that, you know, the film is basically, it's a biography, but it's a four-way biography. You know, it's split between four people. And so that was one of the things that I think was most exciting to me and, you know, to us about telling the story was, how do you weave different biographies together while giving everybody, you know, their due and really also telling a much wider story, a cultural story, a science story, but telling it through people. So, you know, we've mentioned some of these characters already. We've talked a little bit about George Papanicolaou, you know, his intrepid wife, Mary Papanicolaou. You know, it's important to say she's the first woman to ever sit for a pap smear. You know, somebody had to be the first. So there's Mary Papanicolaou, and there's a scientific illustrator, Hashime Moriyama. I'm hoping we'll get to him later. Right. And then there's Helen Dickens. And as Amanda's saying, you know, it's one thing to have a test that works perfectly well in the laboratory. You know, they have established, okay, you can use a pap smear to actually tell if you have cervical cancer. And you can detect that cancer very early. So you're talking about a test that can save hundreds of thousands of lives, you know, millions of lives. And there'd never been anything like that before. You know, again, cervical cancer was a death sentence, as we've said, you know, and the pap smear has the power to cut deaths from cervical cancer about 60%. You know, that's an unbelievable home run. However, you know, like, as Amanda said, that doesn't really mean anything. You know, you've got this thing that succeeds in a lab and you've got to convince people to actually go down and get this test. You know, and for women, you know that it's not necessarily your favorite part of the menu. You know, it can be invasive. It's an intimate test. You have to trust your provider. And you have to remember that in the 50s, this never would have been done before. The routine yearly OBGYN appointment didn't really exist, you know, so it's that level of, you're not just asking them to do something uncomfortable, you're asking them to do something that's never, ever been done. And you know, in the Black communities, as we've been talking about, and in the Black community in Philadelphia, I think in many ways was so lucky to have this woman, Helen Dickens, who was born in Dayton, Ohio, you know, his father was a slave, who goes to medical school, you know, who fights for a position at a time when there were almost none for Black women, and, you know, excels and goes to Philadelphia. You know, she's doing the work of delivering babies. She's doing the work of providing care to some of the city's poorest. She's also an amazing networker. She's establishing a practice that's going to really to change lives across the city. And when she discovers the pap smear, you know, when she first hears about it very, very early on, right at the beginning of this story, right at the, you know, well, not quite at the beginning, but, you know, very early in the 40s, right at the beginning of the popularization, she's going to make it her mission to get it out there and to bring this message out. So I think, you know, working on her story was was really an honor. And we got to work with her daughter and talk about her legacy, which was really exciting to us. And I think it was just a fabulous interview, Amanda. I mean, you can say more.
Yeah, it was great. That was one of my favorite interviews to do, was the interview with Jane Henderson Brown, Dr. Dickens' daughter, who is also herself an OBGYN working in the community. So that was amazing. And she also shared an incredible treasure trove of visual materials with us.
Yeah, and she also shares this great recollection that I think really speaks to the humanity of Helen Dickens when she talks about, you know, her work day would be over. And she would go home and immediately start calling patients to check up on them, you know, to get a little bit more detail on, are they following up on the care, et cetera. It really was a vivid illustration of her dedication. So, Jean, you had mentioned the scientific illustrator, that is Hashima Moriyama, and a Japanese immigrant. And what was the role of scientific illustration? How important was it? And what was it about his illustrations that were so uniquely valuable?
You know, Moriyama's story was one that was really intriguing to us. And you know, he came to the United States a little bit before George Papanicolaou did. And you know, and they struck up a friendship. So they knew each other before, you know, there was any pap test to associate with Papanicolaou. And you know, he could have just been in some ways, you know, a friend at Cornell and, you know, in a context when, you know, maybe George didn't have a lot of friends. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, when we're talking about where we were with cancer research at the time, there was really no effective way to visualize the progression of cancer. And Hashime Moriyama was an unbelievably gifted scientific illustrator who actually patented several devices to be able to make cellular drawings of extreme intricacy and really fine detail. And so the difference that he makes to this story is phenomenal, because he actually is able to produce not just visual aids, but teaching aids for different scientists and different doctors to be able to read the slides from the pap smear. You know, I think, you know, you go in for your pap test and you have the smear done. And then that, when you know, what that produces is cells that actually then have to be analyzed. And so what Moriyama's drawings end up doing is making it so that people can read these slides and help you classify what is a cancer and what isn't, you know, what's dangerous and what is not.
And the intricacy of his drawings made possible the observation of discrepancies in the shape of the cell, the activity of the cell, correct?
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, and I would encourage viewers to watch for his art alone in some ways. You know, there's something for everyone in this film, and his work is really stunning. And I, you know, I'd never looked at cancer cells that way personally, and it led to some interesting conversations in the film team about, you know, basically the beauty of his work. And you know, when you're looking at malignancies, to have them be beautiful, it's not necessarily what you expect, but you know, he made them legible, he made them beautiful, and he was a scientist in his own right as well.
When I was watching the film and seeing his work displayed, one thing that kept coming to mind for me was, how do you scale that? You know, was he teaching from his drawings, or were other illustrators sort of copying his technique? Amanda, did you learn any inside scoop on that process?
I don't know about other illustrators learning. I know that he was really influential in the field of scientific illustration. And, you know, in one of the photographs in the film, you can actually see his drawings up on posters in the background with cytologists at their microscopes referencing his images on the wall. But I think, you know, his story to me also really gets at a very interesting aspect of the film, which is, again, that science doesn't happen in a vacuum, that, you know, this idea that art and science have this interplay, and that, yes, it's about the scientific discovery on one level, but then it is also about so many different forces, including these incredible illustrations that are able to then communicate that discovery to the wider public. So I really loved that about this story from the very start, this idea that art is really an important part of what makes the pap smear such a success.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an excellent point about science not existing in a vacuum, you know, separate from, say, art. And in the film also points out science doesn't exist in a vacuum separate from global events. And Pearl Harbor comes along, and this brilliant individual who's doing this groundbreaking work because of his Japanese ethnicity is hauled off to an internment camp.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's some moments in the story where you sort of start to realize how lucky we are to have the pap smear, and how many moments it really came close to not being a tool that we would have access to. And in the case of Hashimi Moriyama's internment, it was a moment in the film where I think we really had the occasion to work with documents that hadn't been looked at before. And you know, we were able to get through the National Archives this vast compendium, you know, and of bureaucratic, you know, haunting bureaucratic documents that really show the witch hunt that went on at the time and the type of bureaucratic persecution that followed Japanese immigrants and Japanese Americans across the country at this time. And he was in New York at the time of Pearl Harbor, working on this big book project with the Papanicolaus, you know, and the goal is to get this book out there with these illustrations and start, you know, having it be available to other practitioners and to other scientists, other cytologists, as Amanda was saying, to be able to read these slides. And partway through that project, you know, he's arrested, his house is ransacked. He's arrested multiple times. He's pulled in front of multiple hearing boards. And then, you know, that part of the story is unfortunately, you know, a very common part of the story. You know, that's what we're talking about when we talk about, and, you know, he's interned on Ellis Island. And the recommendation is that he be interned for the duration of the war. And so to be able to touch on that history, that is such a big part of our story here in this country, in World War II, not just on the West Coast, but also on the East Coast, was really important to us. And then, you know, the sort of unbelievable thing, the thing that makes it seem like a movie, but that's also so unique that didn't get to happen to other people, was that given the nature of his work, you know, after several months, the Attorney General of the United States actually does intervene and have him released. And so it's both his unique position, you know, that saves him, and, you know, and others did not have that kind of opportunity. So he is able to finish the work, you know, he gets those drawings out there. And I think, you know, for us to be able to tell that story and to work with those documents is something we worked really hard to get right and to bring that story to light.
It really also does show how much the work that they were doing was being recognized at a national level, that it was really finally being seen as this life-changing discovery.
And that attorney general that Jean mentioned was Francis Biddle. And I'm just curious what you discovered around, I don't know anything about Francis Biddle. Was he really tapped into this type of work that was being done and how important it was? Or were there other advocates that were speaking on behalf of Moriyama that brought it to Biddle's attention?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have the exact paper trail, but the advocacy on Moriyama's family's part was tireless. He had two sons. One of his sons wrote multiple letters. His wife wrote as well. Papanikolaou and the scientific team also really advocated on his behalf. You know, when we had, they appeared in hearings, they wrote letters. In some cases, we have their letters of support. It was a full-time project. I assume that the Moriyamas themselves were the ones heading it, but getting contacts to testify to loyalty, you know, asking church contacts, asking old friends to write letters of support. And Moriyama himself was very active, even from Ellis Island, in mounting whatever campaign he could. So, it's one of those situations where... Yes, the work was important, and there's no denying it. But at the same time, you know, you couldn't just sit and wait and hope to be saved. You know, you still had to have this unbelievable network of support, and in some cases, very influential figures. You know, Papanikolaou by this time is pretty well known. His collaborators at Cornell, his collaborators at the American Cancer Society. You know, these were people who were starting to have influence. So we don't know exactly what got Biddle's attention. We don't know if he had, you know, any family history with cancer. We looked for that, you know, to sort of see, was there any kind of link? We didn't find it, but we do know that a lot of people were working very hard, as were other families, you know, and in this case, it did work. Like Amanda said, I think he was doing work. He had the right friends. You know, it's one of those lucky things in a really a dangerous time that can make all the difference to a person's life.
So as we mentioned, these initial tests are taking place around 1928. The pap smear isn't really sort of formalized, I guess, and rolled out to the general public until 1958. Aside from a world war, which is a huge caveat, what accounted for that 30-year sort of slow roll?
That, I think, is one of the most dramatic things about this story is that the scientific discovery did happen in 1928. George Papanikolaou presented it at a conference, and it kind of just fell flat for a variety of reasons. First, it was a eugenics conference, and so I'm not sure they were primed to necessarily be interested in this topic. Second of all, his slides were horrible. The visualization of these precancerous cells or cancerous cells were not easily legible in the way that he presented them. And so they didn't really have much of an impact. And lastly, you know, there was this idea that cervical cancer could be discovered through a biopsy. So why do we need this new highfangled technology? There wasn't so much concern for the comfort of the woman. It was, you know, well, if we can do a biopsy and we can find cancer that way and identify it, what's the big deal? Why do we need something new? So there were, you know, this multitude of forces that kind of led to it not really landing at the time. And then it's interesting to think about what changed over the course of those next 30 years. And one was Hajime Moriyama, who helped to illustrate and visualize the way that these cellular changes were happening. That made it sort of pop for the public in a different kind of way. And also the war on cancer really kind of took off in a new way. And there was tremendous amounts of funding that was poured in, particularly through a woman named Mary Lasker, who was a major philanthropist in cancer research. And then I think just the general feeling post-World War II, where this kind of belief that we could do anything through technology really did kind of shift the mindset of the American public. And so, you know, it was really a question of right research at the wrong place at the wrong time early on, and then later being at the right place at the right time. And George's boss changed at that moment as well. So he had a supervisor who hadn't really taken much interest in his research. that supervisor died, was replaced by somebody new who really saw the promise. And that also made a big difference.
Yeah, it's continually amazing how just great turns of history are so often predicated upon these seemingly minute, you know, changes of characters, changes of settings, changes of circumstances. And along those lines, each of you have a super impressive roster of historical documentaries that you have worked on. And I'm curious, from each of you, what have you learned about telling these types of stories where you want to do service to the science, to the, in this case, the science, the medicine, but you still want to keep it historically relatable for the viewer and to provide a context that the viewer can see themselves maybe fighting the uphill battle that some of our protagonists in the cancer detectives were?
For me, and Amanda may have a different question, but for me, you know, I think it's important for your listeners to know just how much fun we have making these documentaries. And one of my goals is really that even if the material is heavy, that comes through, that you know, that you're learning something new, that this isn't necessarily a story you've heard before, that we're including new voices, that we're thinking about questions a little bit differently. You know, and that we're not, that we're really never sacrificing a good story, but we're always giving you a little bit more. So I think, but you know, the real secret is that, that, you know, we really like this stuff, and that the more complex it is and the more elements there are, the trickier it is to put together and the bigger the challenge, but the, you know, really the more fun, and, you know, and the, working with these editors who really help us hone in and really make these films possible. And in this case, Sandra Christie made such a beautiful film out of these four lives and, you know, what sounds like everything but the kitchen sink. You know, I think that's kind of the secret, sort of, no matter what we get an opportunity to work on, that we try to bring that to bear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, I would say also it is the layers of the story. I mean, I think that there's this danger of, you know, people look at history and they just look at this sort of clean line of the way that things are presented. And in fact, it's always so complicated. There's so many layers to any particular story. And so I just love to kind of be pulling back the curtain on that a little bit in a way that I think does make it relatable. It makes people understand how all these forces come together and all the different currents of history, society, economics, you know, all art, you know, all of these threads really come together in order to get us from point A to point B. And this story was also particularly fun to tell. I mean, I've worked on many films, many projects with American Experience, you know, in terms of, you know, people like William Randolph Hearst, big sort of household name kind of stories. And what I loved about this project was it actually wasn't a household name. I mean, everybody knows the pap smear, but they don't necessarily know that it came from George Papanicolaou. And so doing the really kind of deep digging to find the archive, to find the details, to uncover this in a fresh way for and tell a story that many people have never heard before was really exciting and fun.
Absolutely. And you know, the sort of the red ribbon on top is that you're able to share that since the invention of the pap smear, an estimated 1 million lives have been saved. That's a nice little nugget of history right there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that saved lives. It really does. It still does. Yeah, it's amazing.
So we've been talking about The Cancer Detectives, which will be airing on March the 26th on PBS as part of the American Experience series. And if you don't catch it on the 26th, American Experience does a great job in putting their films up on their website so you can view it at your leisure. I've been speaking with Amanda Pollack, who is the producer and the co-director, and Gene Tempest, who is the writer and also the co-director of this really interesting and informative film. Thank you both for your time. And thank you for this film.
Thank you.